Protests in Iraq have grown more intense. Demonstrators want a complete overhaul of the system. But is it a revolution?
A revolution is a revolution, is what those people are doing on the streets of Baghdad, Basra, Karbala, Najaf, and the other cities.
Also, it's 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. West Germans once tried to tunnel underneath it, and NBC captured it on film.
And they signed a contract, which I've got a copy of, and they say that they will pay them $7,500 if the tunnelers let them film everything.
Like a reality show, but real, and with serious consequences.
They knew that this was an escape operation that could kill them.
An historic escape effort in East Berlin. Also, everybody's a loser when it comes to the U.S.-China trade war. I'm Carol Hills, Low Stories, ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Spin the globe and stop it with your finger. There's a good chance you'll land on a country where people are in revolt. In Iraq, people want change. The street protests there have been violent. The government said today that Iraqi forces have been ordered not to use live ammunition. It's been a bloody scene in Baghdad and other cities. Despite it all, Iraqis remain determined. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
In the street protests happening in Baghdad and a few other cities, something's happening that might not be obvious right away. Iraqis from different backgrounds, people who on a normal day might not have exchanged more than a few words, have come together. For more than 2 weeks now, they've stood up to their government, chanting, marching, dodging tear gas and live ammunition together. Iraqi activist and historian Omar Mohammed says what's happening in Iraq is nothing short of a revolution.
I don't care about what the political scientists say, that there are conditions for a revolution to be called a revolution. This is going to change the country, going to change Iraq for the next generations yet to come. This is a turning point in the Iraqi history.
Mohammed himself fled Iraq 4 years ago. He won't tell me where he is because he and other activists got into trouble with the Iraqi government.
We are threatened. They say, if we see you, we'll kill you. This is the only thing they have promised us.
Mohammed is watching the protests closely. He says he couldn't be more proud of his fellow countrymen.
Believe me, as someone who comes from Mosul, who wasn't feeling that he is represented in this country, now again I feel I am Iraqi.
Protesters in Iraq have been fearless and resourceful. Take, for example, drivers of motorcycle rickshaws, also known as tuk-tuks. They've sort of become the heroes of this uprising. Here's the backstory. When the protests started in October, ambulances had difficulty getting through the crowds to help the injured. Enter the nimble tuk-tuk. Videos from Iraq show three-wheeled tuk-tuks whizzing through the crowd, carrying injured protesters to hospitals, free of charge. Tuk-tuk drivers have become so important for the protests in Iraq that there are now murals celebrating their acts of bravery. Protesters are putting out a newspaper called Tuk-tuk, and a popular Iraqi singer, Hussam al-Rassam, has even dedicated a song to tuk-tuk drivers.
A lot of these people went from nobodies to being somebodies.
Hamza Haddad is an Iraqi political analyst in Baghdad.
Before October, you go to the poor districts and you see tuk-tuks and, you know, they're not your respected occupation. All of a sudden, they've overnight turned into heroes.
Haddad says the protesters are mainly young Iraqis, born around the time of the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. They've grown up under successive democratic governments. But for them, Haddad says, the system is broken. Ola Kadam is an Iraqi scholar at the University of Birmingham in the UK. She says protesters want more from their leaders.
This is a country that has not offered them an opportunity in education, opportunity for work. It has not provided them with their basic services in terms of electricity, sanitation. This is a country that has not provided them with the ability to dream of a better future.
Kadam says Iraqi youth have grown up in the shadows of foreign occupation, war and terrorism. They've only known power-hungry politicians who are only concerned about their own interests. But they're also the generation that has been most connected to the outside world, thanks to YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. The old system that silenced their parents' generation, says Omar Mohammed, the activist, can't silence them. Many of the protesters and their supporters are educated, but they don't have jobs, he says.
I've heard one of the protesters who is more than 25 years old. He says, I still ask my mother to give me money to buy personal stuff. This is unacceptable.
In just over 2 weeks of demonstrations, more than 200 people are dead. Countless are injured. The president and prime minister are promising reforms. But Ola Kadam says that's not enough for the protesters to go home.
There is now a momentum. The protests have increased and they've taken on a kind of do-or-die attitude.
Omar Mohammed says young Iraqis are tired of vague assurances.
This kind of, we will speak, we will talk, we need a dialogue, we will have experts coming to study your demands, etc., etc. It's no more working.
Mohammed says the protesters have been creative in voicing their demands. It's time now for Iraqi politicians to help reach a creative, meaningful solution. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
There's another factor affecting the protests in Iraq, and that's the role of its neighbor, Iran. The World's Chris Wolfe has been looking into that. Chris, I'm seeing a lot of reporting from Iraq suggesting the protesters are being driven by anger against Iran. And I wanted to get a reality check from you because I find this incredibly confusing. What's going on?
It's part of the problem, Carol, but it's very wrong to say it's the whole issue. A majority of Iraqis are Shiite Muslims, just like in Iran. And over the years, Tehran has leveraged that to gain influence over the main political parties in Iraq. So when Iraqis are angry with their politicians, many, by extension, see Iranian influence behind them. I spoke with Balsam Mustafa, an Iraqi scholar currently studying for her PhD in England.
There is an anti-Iran sentiment. We cannot deny this, but it's one aspect. So it's not the full picture. You cannot reduce the protests to this single angle because what drove the protests in the first place was not the Iranian influence in Iraq, but there are other issues.
Issues like Shirin was just reporting on in her piece just now, corruption, lack of jobs and lack of services. Although the demands have grown because of the killings over the past month to demand electoral and constitutional reform and a reduction of Iranian influence.
So how much concern is there in Iraq that Iran might push back to reassert its influence?
Yes, there is some concern. The Iraqi people have the example of Syria, where Iran has helped Assad, President Assad, there put down dissent amongst his own people over the last several years. And already there are some suspicions amongst Iraqis of an Iranian role in previous shootings of protesters inside Iraq. And those fears have not been helped by recent tweets from the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Here's Balsam Mustafa again.
When the supreme leader Khamenei tweeted and he mentioned Lebanon and Iraq and the protests, so people saw this as a blatant interference in the two countries. And some of them also read the tweets as an indirect threat, you know, of escalating things further on the ground.
And it should be noted, Carol, that Iran bankrolled several private armies inside Iraq during the fight to save the country from ISIS, and those militias have not gone away. So Iran has some muscle to call on if it wanted to. But one thing is clear, for the moment, the fear of violent reprisals from the Iraqi government or from Iran or from its proxies is not deterring the protesters.
The World's Chris Wolfe, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Carol.
Basketball fans know Enes Kanter for his relentless offensive rebounding. He signed on with the Boston Celtics this summer. For people who follow global politics, Kanter is more known for his criticism of Turkey's president Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He lashes out against Turkey's leader a lot on social media. All this means Kanter can't return to Turkey anytime soon. But one thing helps him reconnect with his home country, food. WGBH Radio's Esteban Bustillos has more from Boston.
Defeating someone as big and active as Enes Kanter is tough, especially when he has to make it through the grind of an 82-game season plus any potential playoff series. And for the Turkish big man, it's made even more complicated because of his dietary restrictions as a Muslim. Luckily, though, according to Kanter himself, there's one NBA city that ranks above the rest when it comes to halal food.
You know, we were going through these different cities, you know, play games in the road and stuff. And we still remember the best one we had was in Boston.
Back in 2016, when he played for the Oklahoma City Thunder, Kanter was featured in an article by the Wall Street Journal about how he got his teammates there hooked on halal food that follows Islamic law. No pork or wine sauces, for example. He says the best halal food they found was in Boston. And one of the restaurants he's come across during his NBA travels is a Turkish spot downtown.
Every city I go to, the first thing I look at, if there's a good halal restaurant. If it's Turkish or not. So when I come to Boston, I'm like, I'm...
When we meet at the restaurant, Kanter downs two whole plates of lamb, chicken, white bean salad, pita bread, rice, and fries before he's ready to start the interview. The restaurant has become a safe haven for Kanter. He can come in, have a quiet place to eat, and connect with people from his homeland in relative peace and quiet, a rarity for someone with NBA fame. Especially since he can't go back to Turkey safely.
It helps a lot, for sure, because America gave me a lot. America gave me so much, but in the end, you still want to, you know, talk to your own language, talk to your, you know, eat your food and hang out with your own people and stuff. And that's what the food does, that's bringing people together.
For several years now, Kanter has been a vocal critic of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan has cracked down on his political opponents, and his government has revoked Kanter's passport and issued an international arrest warrant. Kanter's experience is similar to other Turks in the United States. Even the owner of the restaurant was reluctant to be interviewed, citing safety concerns for him and his family. Growing up, Kanter remembers his mom in the kitchen making meals like the ones he now eats at the restaurant.
The reason that I came here is like a home-cooked meal. It felt like home-cooked meal because I remember growing up, my mom was making the food, the same food that this restaurant makes, and it kind of like tastes the same.
But not every meal a busy NBA star eats can be from a restaurant that caters specifically to his needs. Especially during a hectic season. That's where the Celtics team chef comes in. Nick Arcuri is in his third season with the Celtics, but has never before had a Muslim player who requires halal food.
Now, we're not a halal kitchen by any means. He's one of many diets we accommodate, but as a performance chef, my goal is to fuel the athlete. So whatever I have to do, we're willing to go out of our way to make sure that these guys eat and stay out of the drive-thru.
It turns out the butcher the Celtics use is halal certified. So now all the chicken the team uses is halal. They also do the little things for Kanter, like making sure they don't cook his food and anything that's had pork in it beforehand, and marking what food is halal in the buffet line where the Celtics practice. It's not necessarily the food he grew up with, but it's these small gestures that mean a lot to Kanter, because something as simple as food can mean much more to a player far from home.
But now when I get a bite of a Turkish food, that's the first thing that comes to my mind, is just, you know, just all the good old days. And it definitely means a lot to me. It's more than food. It's more than a taste. It's a lot of memories.
For the world, Esteban Bustillos, Boston.
Coming right up, tunneling under the Berlin Wall. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. This coming weekend marks 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. But right now, I want to take you back to the early days. Almost immediately after it went up in 1961, people were trying to tunnel under it. Many Berliners in the East were desperate to escape, and others in the West were willing to go to desperate measures to help them. A new podcast from the BBC tells the story of one group of tunnelers and the people who helped them, people like Joachim Rudolph. He was a 22-year-old student in West Berlin when he met a group of diggers. He wasted no time in joining the cause. It was a massive undertaking right under the noses of East German secret police.
They had special listening devices that they'd put on the ground. If they heard something, they'd dig a hole and fire a gun into it or throw in dynamite. So as we dug, We knew that at any time, the ground above our heads could suddenly be ripped open.
An extract from the BBC podcast Tunnel 29. An actor read the students' words, originally recorded in German. The show's producer and host is Helena Merriman. She's been speaking with my colleague, Marco Werman.
One thing I found really striking in your story is the detail you uncovered, like dates and places, even the weather. How did you nail all that down?
Well, I suppose in a way I was lucky that the Stasi, the East German secret police, are such meticulous chroniclers. But also then it was the interviews with tunnelers themselves, Joachim in particular. I wonder whether he might have a photographic memory. His memory is phenomenal, and I spent probably about 8 days straight interviewing him. And he remembered a huge amount. So, for example, when it came to describing the tunnel, he could tell me what it smelt like, the material they were digging out. And he was also the sort of chief inventor of the tunnel. So he was the guy who strung up lights to light up the tunnel when they were digging. He was the one who would attach stovepipes together to bring in fresh air.
You described that the tunnel is the size of a coffin, I mean, that wide. So they're in a really tight space. This is where another player in the whole tunnel scheme gets involved, NBC, the U.S. television network. How in the world did that happen?
It all begins with a guy called Reuven Frank, and he's this hotshot TV executive at NBC News. And he happened to be in Berlin the day the wall went up, and he's transfixed by this story. And he comes up with this idea that what if they were to find an escape story and tell it not after it's happened, but in real time, every twist and turn, not knowing how it will end. And so he instructs his NBC correspondent in Berlin, a guy called Piers Anderton, to start keeping his eye out for an escape story. And at exactly the same time, the tunnelers are realizing they're going to need money because it's expensive doing this. They need more tools. And so they're looking around, asking around in media circles if anyone would be interested in giving them some money. So eventually, the tunnelers find Piers Anderton and they take him to see the tunnel. And he's blown away by it. NBC News amazingly agrees. And they sign a contract and they say that they will pay them $7,500 if the tunnelers let them film everything. And it's broadcast in December 1962. And in the States, something like 18 million people watched it, and it won pretty much every award that year. People say it's the most powerful bit of television they've ever seen.
So we'll come back to that film. But first, that tunnel that Joachim and his friends dig actually floods. And they do manage to find an abandoned tunnel and continue their work. And how does that whole plan go?
So yeah, you're right. The tunnel floods, and they have to wait a few months until it dries out. They're still desperate to get out these friends and family. So they hear about this other tunnel that's been abandoned by the people digging it, and they dig the final few yards into the east. But what they don't realize is that there is a Stasi spy on the edges of this network, and he tells his Stasi handlers everything. So when the tunnelers, when Joachim and the others are breaking through into this cottage in the east, they have no idea that the Stasi are onto them and that they are digging straight up into a trap. Just as Joachim and the others break through into the living room, they start hearing their friends using radios to tell them that something is wrong, and they can hear car horns being beeped, and their friends are saying, turn around, come back, come back. And they don't come back. They keep going.
It made this terrible sound. I'll never forget it. The sound of the axe against the wood. It made the whole of the wooden floor vibrate. And then we heard them again over the radio, calling us to come back. But we were so close. We now had a hole big enough to climb through. We put up a mirror to look into the room. There was no one there, so we climbed up into it. It was a normal living room, sofa, table and chairs, and it was dark. And the only light came through a window with a net curtain over it. And for some reason, I was drawn to that window. And I saw this man in civilian clothes just outside the house, creeping under the window. I knew straight away. He was Stasi.
Wow. Got to ask you, Helena, what happened then?
I'm not going to give away the ending that easily. Come on. But I'll tell you what happened right after that moment, which is they start crawling back into the West. And at the same time, you have all these escapees who were on their way to the tunnel are being arrested by the Stasi. That night, they take them all to this prison. And among them is a guy called Wolf Dieter. And he wanted to get his fiancée, Renata, out of the East. Mm. And so the tunnelers say to him, look, if you go into the East and give messages to the people who want to come out, we'll let Renata come through this tunnel. So Wolf Dieter agrees. And that day, he was in the East, unaware too that the operation has been busted. He's caught and then he's taken to the prison as well, and they interrogate him. That first interrogation goes on for 12 hours.
No water, no meal, no nothing. 12 hours, another 12 hours, and you are dead.
It goes on all through the first night, then another. And bit by bit, he tells them everything. Names, places, dates. And then at the end of the night, they give him a confession to sign. It contains everything he told them. But then he reads all these other bits, how this tunnel operation was all part of a big plot involving West German and American governments.
I said, that's not what I told you. I won't sign that. And he said, you will sign that. You will sign here everything. And he was right. At 5 a.m., I signed the protocol.
Wow. Despite setbacks like that, it is extraordinary that the tunnelers are still determined to go on despite the close call. Did they manage to go under the radar the second time around?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You'd think any normal person at that point would give up. Yet they keep going and they keep the details more secret than before. They choose a different location. Where they really struggle is that they need to find someone else who is willing to go into the East and do the same job that Wolf Dieter did, i.e. be the messenger. Eventually, one of the tunnelers manages to persuade his girlfriend. This is another bit of the story that just fascinated me because it's very spy-like. She has to go into the East and she has to go to various pubs and through coded signals tell the escapees that the operation is on. And she does it brilliantly. She sort of looks like a movie star in the footage. One of the NBC cameramen follows her as she takes this journey into the East. And she can see these escapees around her. Mm. There's one of them who has a baby sitting on her lap, and the baby's been sitting there for so long, the nappy's leaked, and the mother's sitting there with this wet dress. And so I'll leave you there, and people can pick it up at that point.
Indeed you can. The podcast is called Tunnel 29. The BBC's Helena Merriman was speaking with my colleague, Marco Werman. You're with The World. In China, the People's Armed Police is similar to the U.S. National Guard, except...
unlike the National Guard, their main job is rooting out traitors.
And these police are running drills outside of Hong Kong as protests continue inside the city. I'm Carol Hills. That story's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. A controversial pro-Beijing lawmaker in Hong Kong was stabbed in the chest this morning. Junius Ho was wounded but not severely hurt. Police detained the suspected attacker. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, blamed today's violence on pro-democracy protesters there. Lam said, I don't see how these more intense and more violent people can pursue freedom, democracy, or peaceful demonstrations. But pro-democracy campaigners have accused Junius Ho of inciting violence against them. They say Ho conspired with people who assaulted demonstrators in July. Lori Wen condemned today's violence. She's a writer and pro-democracy activist in Hong Kong.
Even though I and my friends who are in the movement, we do not agree with this, but we're not leaving the movement because... this happened.
The protests in Hong Kong have been raging for nearly 6 months with no end in sight. Protesters say they're simply fighting for basic rights, free expression and free elections. But China says they're radical separatists. And in the eyes of the Chinese state, separatists are the lowest of the low. If Beijing does decide to take more drastic measures to crack down on the protests in Hong Kong, what could that look like? Here's The World's Patrick Nguyen to explain.
Chinese officials say these protesters... they're more like violent radicals, egged on by the U.S., foot soldiers of external forces, they call them, showing signs of terrorism and hoping to split Hong Kong from China. And if these protesters don't stand down, well...
Chinese President Xi Jinping has warned any attempts to split the country will lead to, quote, bodies smashed and bones ground to powder.
You hear that? And it's hard not to think of this. Tiananmen Square, 1989, in Beijing, a popular uprising against authoritarianism, violently crushed by the People's Liberation Army, or PLA. So you may be wondering, Xi Jinping, is he going to send in PLA troops and tanks to Hong Kong? Not likely, because if there's a military-style crackdown, still a big if, it would probably involve these guys, the People's Armed Police. Like the PLA, they answer to President Xi. But while the army is focused on foreign attacks, the People's Armed Police crushes internal threats, like perceived terrorist or separatist. Here they are in a promotional video, blasting assault rifles, raiding compounds, jumping out of helicopters, and generally being super hardcore.
Although it has police in its name, the People's Armed Police is essentially a paramilitary force.
That's Joel Wuthnow, an expert on the PAP with the National Defense University.
Folks in the PAP wear military uniforms, they have military training, and they use military-grade equipment. So listeners in the U.S., the closest equivalent would be the National Guard.
Like the National Guard, they're a fast reaction force, coming to the rescue if there's an earthquake or forest fire. Unlike the National Guard, their main job is rooting out traitors, such as people in Tibet asking for more autonomy, or so-called terrorists in Xinjiang, homeland of the Uyghurs, a Muslim group. Beijing has tried to stamp out their religion and culture and has put about 1 million Uyghurs in re-education camps. And if you go to Xinjiang, you will run into the People's Armed Police.
They sit on street corners in armored personnel carriers. They have submachine guns. They're a presence. Really what they're doing is deterring people in Xinjiang from thinking about any kind of collective action.
Some Hong Kongers tell me they feel that could happen here.
We are facing the dictatorship of the Chinese Communist Party. If we lose, Hong Kong might become the next Xinjiang.
That is Lam Chuk Ting, an elected official. Now, what Xinjiang faces is way harsher than anything in Hong Kong. But as protesters are quick to note, Hong Kong's police, they've been to Xinjiang to train with the PAP. And in Xinjiang, up in the snowy hills of western China, they do not have to hold back. Here they are on the news, going after bad guys with no restraint. You can see why Hong Kongers might be freaked out, because the People's Armed Police are training to stop their protest too, the one in Hong Kong. They've been doing riot control drills just over the border from Hong Kong, and the message is pretty clear. Stand down. Don't make us come over there. But Wuthnow, the PAP expert, says chances are that won't happen. This isn't 1989, and unlike Xinjiang, Hong Kong is not a remote province on lockdown.
Everything the PAP does will be captured on photograph, on video, and broadcast to the entire world.
And China, he says, really doesn't need that PR nightmare.
Any intervention would be a light go in, not necessarily in overwhelming numbers, try to maintain order. You know, it would not be a high-end slaughter. And they're also potentially would be going up against protesters now with months of experience evading and combating the Hong Kong police.
Wuthnow says China's red line would be if the protests started spreading to the mainland. Then, he says, Beijing might send them in. In the meantime, Hong Kong's police force has proven it can be pretty hardcore, too. They're bashing people with batons, blasting them with tear gas. Here's a video from Twitter, riot cops dogpiling on a skinny protester, mashing his face into the street. Actually, many Hong Kongers say it's not a question of when or if the People's Armed Police storm the city. A recent independent poll asked, do you believe the PAP has already infiltrated Hong Kong's police, secretly carrying out the wishes of Beijing? More than 60% said yes. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Hong Kong.
No more tariffs. That's China's request to the self-proclaimed tariff man. The tariff man being President Trump, of course. China and the U.S. were scheduled to meet later this month to hash out the start of a truce to their ongoing trade war. They're supposed to meet at a conference in Chile, but that's been canceled because of protests in Santiago. Joining me now is The World's Jason Margolis. Jason, you've been covering the trade war from the start, but I haven't seen you in a while. What's new?
Oh, it's good to be back, Carol. So what's new is basically we are reconfirming what we already knew, and that is this trade war is a lose-lose situation. We have some fresh data from the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, and looks like the people are getting hurt are the usual suspects, American consumers, American farmers.
Okay, I'm a consumer. I want to know how much I'm losing.
Get to the point. Well, that's a good question. It depends on the household, but between $500 and $1,700 a year.
In what kind of products?
Well, there are thousands of products on these lists, imported products that are now subject to tariffs. Buttons, car seats, axles, hairnets, I was looking through them earlier, silk, onions, tuna. So what it means is if you're buying something, say you're buying a shirt and maybe cotton is on the list and buttons, so you're paying a little bit more.
So it's often the components within a product you're buying that have been affected by the tariffs.
Exactly. But tariffs are scheduled that will directly impact consumer items. And those are scheduled for December. But let me get back to the other people that are getting hurt by this, and that is Chinese companies are being hurt. Their economy is slowing down, and President Trump makes great fanfare out of this. But on the other side of the coin, U.S. companies are also slowing down. Our exports to China are dropping month after month. So even though China is selling less stuff to the United States, American companies, American farms are selling less stuff to China. So again, it's a lose-lose.
And are there any winners here?
Well, the winners are the countries that are picking up the slack. Taiwan, Mexico, the European Union, they are selling stuff to the United States that China used to.
But it still doesn't mean we're winning, does it?
Exactly. We're just buying our goods from another store.
So what about the truce that China and the U.S. seem to be wanting to have, but there's nothing happening there? Where are we?
Right. So in early October, President Trump came out and said, we've reached a deal. But there was actually no deal on paper. So they're working on that right now. They were supposed to meet down in Chile. As you mentioned, that conference got canceled. They're looking for another venue. It's very ambiguous what will be in the truce, what it means. It's being met with a lot of skepticism, healthy skepticism. But we'll see in the next few weeks.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
Cities are built for all of us to work, play, and live in, but they haven't been built by all of us. Generations and generations of men have put their mark on urban design. But what if cities were designed by women? Could they be different, possibly even better, for everyone? The BBC's Stephanie Higarty takes us to Barcelona to see how a feminist movement is making a mark on urban planning.
Conchi Braucos is walking down a dark street on the outskirts of Barcelona. Under these high-rise tower blocks, the streets are deathly quiet. It's 3 o'clock in the morning.
La iluminación, por ejemplo, aquí, que nula.
She scurries past the scary parts, pointing out where there's no light at all. Conchi has to do this walk almost every morning because she's a cleaner at a hospital and it's too early for public transport.
Lo piensa decir.
It's something that nobody thinks about. How do people travel at 3 or 4 in the morning?
How safe we feel, especially at night, is just one of thousands of ways that men and women experience a city differently. That's something that Sara Ortiz and Blanca Valdivia have been obsessing about for over a decade. They set up PUNT 6, a collective of architects, sociologists and urban planners, to study the different ways that men and women use space. And they're particularly obsessed with things like benches and toilets.
We need to eat more often, and also, because of our menstrual cycle, we need toilets for more things.
Benches are not just for socializing. They're a basic necessity for mobility, for people who are sick, for people with disabilities, and for carers or childminders.
4 years ago, Barcelona elected its first female mayor. Ada Colau has embarked on a profoundly feminist agenda. She's putting young women in key posts.
Okay. Hola.
Hi.
Janet Sanz is Barcelona's councillor for urbanism and is implementing one of the city's most ambitious projects. She wants to take back the streets from cars. Research by Punt 6, the collective, says that the majority of drivers in Barcelona are men. Women tend to travel more by foot or on public transport.
Pensar que en Barcelona aproximadamente
about 60% of Barcelona's public space is occupied by cars, either while driving or parked. The moment you redistribute that space and make the use of the space more equal, you're supporting groups that until now have had no access to that space.
I'm standing in the middle of the street where parents are zipping by on their scooters with their kids taking them to school. Instead of cars and traffic, I'm surrounded in benches and plant boxes. The effect is to block this junction off from traffic, creating a mini park in the middle of the street. It's called the Superia, Superblocks. There's 6 superblocks in Barcelona so far, and the plan is to create more than 500. Ada Colau and her team can't show us what a city would look like if it was built by women.
It's obvious that in 5 years you can't overcome 2,000 years of patriarchy.
But they can give us a glimpse of what a city might look like if everyone had a seat at the table.
The BBC's Stephanie Hagarty reporting from Barcelona. Meanwhile, more details from the impeachment inquiry are coming out. This afternoon, House investigators released a transcript of their closed-door interview with William Taylor, the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine. The veteran State Department official describes the U.S. embassy in Kyiv as a snake pit. Taylor says he became aware that President Trump was holding back security aid for Ukraine and that Trump would release the aid only after the Ukrainian president made an announcement publicly. President Volodymyr Zelensky was required to say that his government was investigating alleged corruption in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and that they were looking into Burisma, the company that hired Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff says public hearings begins next week, starting with Ambassador Taylor.
So those open hearings will be an opportunity for the American people to evaluate the witnesses for themselves, to make their own determinations about the credibility of the witnesses, but also to learn firsthand about the facts of the president's misconduct.
Ambassador Laura Kennedy is a retired career diplomat who served alongside Bill Taylor for more than 2 decades. She calls him an icon at the State Department and said that many former colleagues were disappointed that President Trump and others have criticized Taylor's service.
To hear someone like Bill Taylor described as a radical, unelected bureaucrat when he is such a distinguished man who's given his entire adult life to public service, it's appalling and it's noticed by every single employee at the State Department. Even though there's Democrats, there are Republicans, but when you have this unwillingness to stand up for the people, that's something that cuts right across this institution.
We'll hear more from Ambassador Kennedy tomorrow. President Trump officially signed off on next year's annual cap for refugees, bringing it to an historic low, 18,000. That's a huge drop from 110,000 refugees, the cap set by President Obama in 2016, his last year in office. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joins us now to tell us more. Monica, can you just recap on the current status of the U.S. refugee program and what's going to happen in 2020?
Well, 18,000 is definitely the lowest number we've seen in the refugee program since it began in 1980. So this is a dramatic, dramatic drop.
I also see that the Trump administration has issued another change to the refugee program, which is an executive order that makes it possible for states to basically opt out of accepting refugees. What does that really mean?
So the order requires state and local government officials now to sign a letter to the State Department saying, we support refugee resettlement. If they don't sign a letter, if they don't offer that kind of affirmative consent, that means that that state or that local government will not accept refugees.
So it's either a governor can wholesale say the state won't accept refugees, or a city or town can say no and the governor has to enforce that.
That's exactly right. The deadline for this is December 25th, Christmas Day. So if refugee resettlement agencies and people who work with refugees are really watching what is happening, and we've seen some governors already issue their support. The governor of Utah, who's a Republican, issued his support for the refugee program. And a couple of other governors have already too, but we're still waiting to see what Texas does. Texas receives the most refugees of any state in the country.
How is the Trump administration explaining what's behind these drastic steps?
When it comes to why we're seeing fewer refugees accepted into the United States in general, Trump administration officials say that they are working on diplomacy abroad, that they're working to address the wars and the conflicts that make people leave their homes to begin with, and that accepting refugees in the United States is not the most sufficient way to deal with global problems. It's to go to the root of the problems. In terms of this executive order and giving more weight to the voices of state and local officials, they say that consultation is insufficient and that there needs to be closer coordination between state and local governments when it comes to refugee resettlement. That's what the government says is behind this executive order.
Monica, what are you hearing in terms of the possible fallout from slashing the U.S. refugee cap? I mean, how much is it affecting refugee communities here?
Well, it puts a lot of families in massive limbo. Refugee families generally don't come all at once. People get separated by conflict, by war. I spoke with one woman who is a pretty typical case right now about this. Her name is Jackie, and we're just going to use her first name because she was a gay rights activist in Uganda and continues to face threats. When she fled, literally with just her belongings and the shirt on her back, she left her 2-year-old boy behind. She wasn't able to take her 2-year-old with her. So she's in Columbus, Ohio now, and she's been here waiting now for several years to have her son reunite with her. And with this recent cut in the U.S. refugee program, she's very worried that it may take several more years for her and her son to be in the same place in the United States. And this is what she told me.
I feel like our chances are getting reduced, you know, because that's the number through which my son can get here. I've been told that previously it was a little bit easier, but now nobody knows. I have to look outside the box. It looks like I'll never have my son with me.
And when she says looking outside the box, what is she thinking about?
Well, she's facing some hard choices, and she told me she is considering another way of having her son near to her, and this is what she said.
I'm thinking having my son getting adopted by a Canadian family. This family has been close to me since I was a refugee. They can still help me have him adopted over there so that he lives closer to me.
Did I hear that right, that she is going to try to have her son adopted by a family in Canada? So while she lives in Ohio, he'd be over the border in Canada, but at least be closer to her?
That is a serious consideration for her, yes. To have her son leave Uganda, be closer to her, albeit in Canada, in Ontario, this particular family. But it also leaves Jackie with a choice, which is a tough choice. She could remain in Ohio and see her son in Canada, or she could decide to uproot and go and live in Canada and be with him.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. Thanks a lot, Monica.
You're welcome.
Finally today, anywhere you have a lot of horses, you're going to get a lot of manure. Here's the World's Amanda McGowan.
The Helsinki International Horse Show wrapped up last week. 370 horses, 5 days. Over 100 tons of manure. But this is a little different because a Finnish energy company called Fortum took all of that waste and made electricity from it. Enough to power the entire horse show, in fact, and then some.
There is actually quite a lot of energy in horse manure.
That's Anssi Paalinen from Fortum's horsepower division. Yes, really. This project was his idea.
My wife rides, and I can understand the situation when it's in the stables, that horses produce a lot of manure. Typical Finnish horse produces up to 8 to even 10 tons of manure per year.
That volume is a big problem. In the EU, dumping manure in landfills is tightly regulated.
If you decompose manure in an uncontrolled way, then the decomposing manure creates methane.
Or methane. And it's an extremely powerful greenhouse gas that contributes to global warming. So Fortum collects the manure, mixes it with stuff like wood chips and sawdust, and burns it to generate power. They've done it for a few years now at the Helsinki Horse Show, but they also work with 300 stables in Finland to collect manure year-round. Paulinen says he could see this concept expanding across the continent.
There's 75,000 horses in Finland and there's 6 million horses in Europe. So obviously there are potential uses for this concept outside Finland.
Paulinen says one unusual part of the job is just talking about the raw material. He says when they started out, they had long discussions about what word to use to refer to, well, the waste.
We had a long discussion of what terms we should use. What is dung and what is manure? And that's in different languages. It was really, really funny discussions and a bunch of kind of serious scientists and engineers discussing about what to call different types of excrement.
They settled on manure. It's a renewable energy source, an extremely renewable source. For the World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
And we'll renew our show again tomorrow. For the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.